This is Dylan FM, a Freak Music Club podcast. I'm Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place. This season, we're going deep on Time Out of Mind to celebrate its 25th anniversary. Here's your host, Craig Danieloff.
Whirligig is a new book that takes an interesting look at the making of Time Out of Mind. It's named after a note in the recording logs that referenced the organ Jim Dickinson was playing on the sessions. Even after focusing deeply on Time Out of Mind for a year now, nearly everything in this book was new to me because the author had two unique advantages in writing it. First, he'd been a personal friend of Jim Dickinson for over a decade before Jim's death in 2009. Dickinson was a truly legendary musician and producer who'd played with an incredible number of people, including Aretha Franklin, Sam and Dave, Ry Cooder, and many more, and produced a lot of great records too. But he played an instrumental role in the making of Time Out of Mind, as you'll hear today. Secondly, the author had been to Tulsa and had the chance to listen to all 500 recordings from the Time Out of Mind sessions and see all the written lyrics and other materials. Each of these advantages gave him information and perspective that nobody else has had on the making of Time Out of Mind. A set of first-person stories and a review of the actual historical records, memories plus facts. You can find a lengthy review of the book on our Substack, which I hope you'll take a few minutes to read. There's a link in the show notes. The author's name is John Lewis, and today we're going to talk to John about the writing of the Whirligig book and the making of Time Out of Mind. John is an award-winning writer and the editor-at-large of Baltimore Magazine. He's written for Rolling Stone, Spin, The Oxford American, and others, and has been a guest lecturer at Johns Hopkins University and others. This will not be the fattest book on your Bob Dylan bookshelf, and actually it may be the slimmest, but every page is compelling. The layout and illustrations are great, which you can't say about many Dylan books, and it leaves you with just a better sense of what it was like when they made Time Out of Mind. It's just a good book. Now, here's my conversation with Whirligig author John Lewis. Hi, welcome. Thanks for joining us to talk about this great book, Whirligig. Let's back up a step, though. Tell me how you came to Dylan and your background with Dylan, and then we'll go into how you picked this and got to Tulsa.
You know, someone who loves Dylan had always been kind of a giant in my musical world. Although like a lot of folks or older folks, I never really felt like I had a Dylan album that came out in real time that I could call my own. You know, I mean, listening to the albums from the 60s and the 70s, it felt like I was coming in, like I'm 58 now. So I started to really kind of like, you know, subscribing to Rolling Stone and stuff in like 1978, 79. And so much of the talk was, Dylan's over, you know, it made me feel like, well, I missed the boat, you know. And then the 80s hit, and in some respects, that kind of reinforced some of that, you know. It's there wasn't like a great critically acclaimed Dylan record, and to my ears, Time Out of Mind changed that in such a huge way. And I felt like from the very first notes, from the very first few minutes of it, I think one of your guests, was it Jeff Slade who was talking about that?
Jeff says took the day off when he got the album. Yeah.
Yeah. And I can relate to that. I got an advance from Columbia. I did a lot of, you know, writing about music and musicians. And I remember putting it in, and I say in my book, I actually turned my head and looked at the speakers. I mean, I was like, wow, this sounds like we're on to something completely different, completely new. It sounded to me like, maybe it was more honest. It was more upfront. And it was kind of beautiful. I mean, it was great. And, you know, Lovesick was the first song on that sampler. And I just remember thinking too, like, was he going to be able to sustain this over the duration of an album? And he was. And at that point too, I had heard a lot about the album from Jim Dickinson, who played on it and who I had known for a number of years.
What transition that, so that's 25 years ago, to deciding to work on this project. Obviously, Jim, I'm sure, plays a factor. And then getting yourself down to Tulsa and into the archives.
Yeah, I mean, I had known Jim for a number of years. We were introduced by a mutual friend who said, you know, you guys would probably hit it off. And we did. And Jim and I talked every couple of weeks, probably from the mid-90s until he passed in 2009. And Jim was a fantastic, maybe the best storyteller I've ever come across in my life. And he almost felt like he had an obligation as a kind of oral historian to pass on what he experienced and what he knew, which was fantastic for somebody like me who cares about these things. And if you are familiar with people who work with Dylan, most of them do not speak candidly, if at all, about the experience. Jim was just the opposite. Jim would talk about the smallest details. So I say that because I had had any number of conversations about Time Out of Mind from the week after Jim returned from Miami, going forward to when the album was released and getting his thoughts on that, and then just having it come up over time, you know, about Dylan's creative process and him thinking back on those sessions. So I had a fair amount of kind of inside information before I went. When I heard that there was an archive in Tulsa, I got in touch, said that, you know, I had some information and was just curious about, I wanted to review all of their Time Out of Mind material. They have a, you know, like an archival search mechanism where you can see, and then you have to request what you want and have a research proposal. So I submitted all that and basically wanted to see everything they had, including scraps written on hotel stationery in the couple years leading up to Time Out of Mind. Letters with Columbia Records, the lyric sheets that were available, and then the digital audio files that are archived there. And that was a substantial amount of stuff to go through. So I went down there. My proposal was approved, and I flew down there. I got in just before pandemic, before the lockdown. I went down at the end of January in 2020.
Wow.
And basically, I mean, I'm accustomed to writing, you know, magazine profiles, reviews. I kind of went down there keeping it open-ended. And I really wanted to, I mean, I'm not a Dylan scholar, but I had heard so much about the sessions for the week that Jim was there. And then over the years had heard things about the Teatro sessions prior and then how, you know, the finished production went. So I was really curious. I wanted to go down and review all of the, you know, the lyric stuff, but I also wanted to hear chronologically from start to finish, really the arc of those sessions. And of course, I was curious if I could hear any changes or anything substantive when Jim appeared, when he turned up in Miami.
Boy, a whole bunch of questions as someone who's tried to piece together this story for the last year and more come to mind. But is there any evidence that you saw of recording sessions for the Time Out of Mind material before Oxnard, so before August of 96? There's rumors of a band recording. There's rumors of something done with Ronnie Wood in Scotland or Ireland somewhere. Any of that that you saw information about?
Not that I didn't see anything archived. I mean, I went through hundreds of digital files along with the session sheets. So it was documented, okay, you know, the dates, who played when and where. But I didn't see anything, because I'd heard about that as well. I'd heard rumors about the band with, and then with Ron Wood. But I didn't come across anything that predated the Teatro.
Okay, interesting. So I'm going to read a quote from your book now. I've got a series of them to kick off some of our discussion. So in terms of that audio, you said, the audio ranged from skeletal demos to polished mixes, and even included Dylan and Lawab in between song banter. It was revelatory. Let's talk about Oxnard first. Obviously, it turns out we're doing this after we've all had a little time with Fragments, and we've got seven, I think, if I'm right, tracks from Oxnard now. Tell us more about what you heard at Oxnard. Again, this is for the diehards, and we sort of care about those noodling and those songs taking shape. What more about that in the Oxnard tapes were you able to hear?
Well, for one, let me say I love Fragments. I mean, I think it's a great set. Thank goodness it exists. I mean, I can't get enough of it. In part because I thought I would never hear some of this stuff ever again, you know, when I left Tulsa. So that said, it's also a much, much, much different experience than listening to a lot of things, from Skeletal to It's Coming Together to, you know, different takes, different mixes of those takes. I mean, there's so much in Tulsa, that it felt also a little frustrating listening to Fragments. Now, one of the things I thought was most revelatory was that studio banter. The tape is rolling, and one of the first things I hear Dylan say is, and this is in the book, he says to Lanois, "What do you do for musicians around here?" and which is really fascinating when you consider what the Time Out of Mind sessions became in Miami. So Dylan shows up at Lanois' studio, and it's close to Dylan's home. And he shows up, and it's Dylan, it's Lanois, it's Tony Mangurian. And I saw somebody say that they thought Tony, Dylan's bass player, you know, was there. But I didn't see evidence of that. I didn't see or hear that.
He's listed in the liner notes, and coincidentally, I got to talk to Tony two nights ago, and I asked him, and he was not there.
Okay, good, because I mean, I had seen that, and I thought, geez, I mean, I don't recall coming across anything that he was present. So it's fascinating that, you know, Dylan shows up there. He's got this great batch of lyrics in process. And kind of in his head, he had said he wanted to do something. He was impressed with Beck. And it seemed like Lanois kind of wanted to run with that, doing looped percussion. And some of that stuff that I heard, and it's not on Fragments, I think I say in the book, it almost sounded like John Spencer Blues Explosion outtakes, a couple of the loops and takes, and definitely not a direction that, you know, I'm glad they didn't pursue it. But there were a number of directions, but then there were some really beautiful things that emerged. I mean, you can hear it. Some of those songs from Teatro are stunning. I mean, they're beautiful. They're incredible. And I can understand some of Lanois' frustration because later on, too, he even referenced some of that, wanting Dylan to go back to kind of the way he did something. And as you're well aware, he's usually not up for that. But you could hear, and also in the early Criteria sessions, that studio banter, a lot of frustration on Dylan's part. Frustrations with saying things like, you know, are we going to put that beat to it again? That came up a number of times. So it sounded like Lanois was sort of pushing that. And I say pushing that, it was something too that Dylan expressed interest in at the outset. But it seemed like it generated a fair amount of frustration and not anything close to a clear direction for a project, you know, for what would become a completed project.
So in Oxnard, did you get the sense that they were making an album or they were fooling around and getting to know each other?
I think they were kind of casting about a little bit for what it would be. I think because they potentially had different ideas of where it could go, to me, none of that stuff feels like it was a completed project. So they definitely didn't get there to where I felt like what I heard at Teatro, that you could take, say, 11 or however many songs and make an album of it and it would feel cohesive. I would say no, not at all. So I think there was a certain amount of casting about, but I also think, too, that there was, you know, going into it, it didn't feel like, oh, these are demos that we're going to take and move to Miami.
Miami move has always been a little mysterious in the way everyone talks about it, right? I talked to Mark about it and Dan's talked about it, and it's just like Bob said, we gotta go, we're going, this is where he picked, boom. Which, you know, Bob gets to do what he gets wants to do, but you know, and then as you point out, the difference between, you know, basically a producer and one musician and an engineer and a dozen or 15, whatever it wound up being, people, there's a huge night and day happened. But how it fit, which is what you're saying. I mean, that's why it's interesting what it felt like then. It clearly became something very specific and different when they got to Miami.
To my mind, it's fascinating that in so many ways, it became the polar opposite of what was going on at Teatro.
How?
Well, it went from like, what do you do for here for musicians, to 12 people playing simultaneously in the same room. It went from Lanois' kind of home studio in a place where, you know, I guess Lanois, Mark, Howard, and Dylan could, if they wanted, ride their motorcycles to work each day. It went as far away almost geographically as you could possibly get in the United States from that spot, the Teatro, to Miami, Florida. So it's fascinating to me too that even geographically, they turned it completely upside down. The studio itself, as Mark Howard describes, it's not like it was kind of state of the art. Everything was completely set up, just show up. I mean, from what I've read with Mark, that, you know, they loaded up equipment, they trucked it across country. And when he got there, he was, I don't want to say mortified, but it was a challenge to set it up in a way that would be, if not optimal, but that would work for a Daniel Lanois, Mark Howard engineered project. And
even the criteria wasn't automatic. They tried to get other studios. They tried to get a Masonic temple.
Right. They tried, they called the Bee Gees.
Right.
So yeah, and they ended up with criteria, which again to me is fascinating, in part because it's where when Jim Dinkinson was kind of like part of an Atlantic Records rhythm section or house band south, the Dixie Flyers, they worked out of Criteria Studios in Miami. So really fascinating that they showed up there with 12 musicians and the last person through the door that they summon is Jim.
So early in the book, and I don't have marked here whether it was still at Teatro or right as they arrived at Criterion, but you say the struggle for the soul of Time Out of Mind had begun. So tell us when you came to that realization in the tapes or in talking to Jim. I guess Jim came probably a little bit later, so this sounds like something you heard on the tapes.
Yeah, I mean, it's really fascinating, Craig, too, because It was kind of strange because at one point I realized I'm knowing a lot more about this project than Jim ever knew, because I was hearing the chronological, like the skeletal criteria stuff, going through like the Beck stuff, the kind of gems, you know, like Dylan at the piano at Teatro. It's like, wow, that's incredible. That's beautiful. I'd love to hear an album of just that, to or scrapping that, to, you know, 12 people. So I was... the struggle for the soul of Time Out of Mind, I think I started to realize that when they made the move, some strange things kind of happened. The first one being that there are tapes of the day, 2 days before Dylan shows up, Lanois has the band there and he's running through the songs. And at first I thought, am I hearing this wrong? This sounds like, what am I hearing here? It's Lanois running through the songs from Time Out of Mind, which he had, you know, heard some, you know, Teatro done, recorded some. And he's cueing the band to these crescendos that are almost like right out of Dylan 1966. And he's singing the songs as well, in some cases making up lyrics, in some cases singing the lyrics that ended up, you know, because again, they were still in process. But
so there's the album we need. We need the Lanois Sings Tomb album.
Well, there's something. It's really an odd experience hearing that. It's not only odd hearing him leading the band, it's hearing these songs that we all know and love, but it's like coaxing them back to 1966. And I think my jaw dropped when I heard that, because the Teatro, as we were saying, as you were saying too, it presents possibilities, you know? I mean, when I listen to Teatro, you know, you could go to Criterion and think like, okay, we're going to do some kind of beat heavy thing. We're going to do that. We're going to do like a gospel inflected thing. We're going to do a blues. We're going to do almost like that power trio rock thing, you know, a big, big sound. It was really kind of disorienting to hear Lanois leading through the band and, you know, whether he was thinking, geez, if I could get Dylan to sound like 1966, they're going to talk about me like I'm the risen Christ, because, you know, I was able to coax this classic Dylan out of him again. So that's kind of what the band was playing before Dylan showed up. And it's very kind of strange. And hey, I give Lanois personally a lot of credit, because I love Time Out of Mind so much. And the finished product, I mean, to me, it's a masterpiece. I love it. I loved it the first time I heard it. I love it today. But some of the, you mentioned in, you wrote about, or like you mentioned intentionality. Some of the intent to me seemed like odd directions, odd paths to choose to try to go down. And that's the one thing that I feel like I never had a problem with Lanois's production. I think it's fantastic. I love the mystery and the meaning that it, you know, sort of underscores. I think it's beautiful. I think it's a great match. But when you hear, again, like this arc from beginning to end, you think, or I was thinking, like, thank God Dylan kind of had a sense, intuited, where these songs should go, because he was presented time and time again with opportunities to move them in a direction that, you know, Time Out of Mind would have been nothing like. I mean, early Criteria sessions, Dylan is saying, again, more frustration and the studio banter. He's saying things like, what, are we going to do it with that beat again? Are we going to put that beat to it again? I'm confused by this beat. What are we, you know, what are we doing with this beat? He says it over and over again, and Lanois would say, yeah. Or then Lanois would say, well, let's try it with the crescendos. So, you know, he would try and circle back and like, okay, we'll try it if we're not going to do the beat thing. So that kind of Beck beat approach, and then that with the crescendos, it comes up a number of times. And again, Dylan, to his credit, I think steered it in another direction. I heard somebody recently say that it was Lanois fighting Dylan for that. I mean, I think there's so many, again, Time Out of Mind is so great. I think it lends like a ton of interpretation. I think there's so many truths. I would love to hear extensive interviews with everybody involved. And that's why I think what you're doing is so fantastic. But that's not the sense that I got. I didn't get the sense that Lanois was sort of trying to wrestle Dylan towards this vision that he had. I got almost the opposite sense, that Lanois was trying to move him in these directions, and that Dylan wasn't buying into it. And then I think that was also the source of a lot of this, you know, tension that we hear about in those sessions.
So one thing I wanted to ask you about your time in Tulsa was, Clinton Halen writes about being in Tulsa, and there was some guy spending all his time lurched over the Time Out of Mind material, including the videotapes. And Halen is like, you know, you've got 60 years of great stuff here. Why are you focused on Time Out of Mind? A, was that you? Which, more importantly, is a way to say, did you get to watch the videotapes?
No, I wasn't there when he was there. I emailed him. Mark put me in touch. Mark, the archivist at the archive, the librarian, he put me in touch with Clinton prior to try and get a sense, because Clinton had already been there, and he thought that he might give me a sense of how long I needed to review the materials. I wasn't offered the opportunity to look through the videotapes from that period. I had all of the digital audio tapes, which were extensive. I think my head may have exploded if I had access to the video, but no, that wasn't something that I was able to review.
Oh, so wow. I thought we'd solve that mystery, meaning who was it? Assuming I don't know who it was that. You. It wasn't
no,
you.
It was not
know.
Me.
We really don't know. Well, the interesting thing about it, just for trivia, as I've been told, and this may be reflected in why you didn't see them, that they were later pulled and are now no longer even available to researchers. So whoever that was is probably the only person that will ever see them, or until, you know, they get out of whatever lockbox they're in, which may be, you know, a few years. So anyway, all right, we can move on. I thought we were going to get another secret out of you with the contents of the videotapes.
No, but can I add something too? You know, as a researcher going in there, you're only allowed to take a pencil and a paper. You're not allowed, obviously, no phone, no recording device, no laptop. So I had literally like composition books like from your elementary school days, and you know, three number two pencils and a pencil sharpener. And that's how I spent, you know, from, you know, 8 a.m. to 5, 6 p.m. just scribbling, you know. And
amazing. Well, it's still amazing that they have them, that you were able to go, and obviously the portion they're sharing with the public, but it's very, very cool. All right, well, let's move on to Jim Dickinson a little bit, because, you know, we talked about Teatro, we talked about the beginning of Miami. You know, Jim shows up on the 14th, but give us, you know, you had this relationship with him, which is incredible. Tell us a little bit about Jim, and then lead into his impact and appearance in Miami.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, folks can look up Jim's credits. I mean, he played on Sticky Fingers piano on Wild Horses. He, you know, Aretha Franklin's Spirit in the Dark. He produced Big Star's third album. He produced The Replacements, Please to Meet Me. He just has an incredible resume. Played live with people like Little Richard, Chuck Berry. You know, he's just been, it's like he's seen it all practically from the inside.
Yeah.
So when Jim got back, I talked to Jim the week after he returned from Criteria, and he was like buoyant. I mean, he was, for one, he said that the sessions were like kind of the craziest, super professional. I mean, he said he's hardly ever seen someone so professional as Bob Dylan on those sessions. But when he was picked up at the airport, I think a roadie picked him up and said that there were 11 people there before him. And he knew Augie Myers. He knew Jim Keltner. I think the other players he didn't really know or have a personal relationship with. He assumed that they were all in hotels being called as they needed to lay down parts. And he said that to the guy who was driving him, I guess, to the studio or wherever. And the guy said, no, they're all assembled in the studio, playing simultaneously. and Jim was stunned to hear that. And you know, and we all know, I mean, the instrumentation is kind of nuts.
On those early tapes, are there versions in the mixes or the non-mixes that you hear that kind of cacophony? Because even now that we've got the fragments of the In the Room, right? It's they gave them to an engineer to mix into something comprehensive or logical. What were you able to hear?
Yeah, Craig. I mean, it's funny. There was one take of Can't Wait that I write about, you know, almost like it was a 7 minute and 20 minute version of Can't Wait. And well, for one, Jim had told me that there would be this kind of chaos of everyone playing together. It would all come together. And he said it would be a thing of like stunning beauty. And then it may just sort of fall apart. What I heard that kind of came closest to that. Oh, and the other thing too, is that he didn't wear headphones when he was. So on the floor, he said Dylan didn't wear headphones. He wanted to hear what Dylan was hearing. So he also said what was coming through the headphones was completely shitty. It sounded awful. So he heard, you know, the 11, 12 people playing simultaneously, this kind of chaos, dissonance, like congealing into something totally beautiful, maybe falling apart. He experienced that in real time. I don't really hear anything like that on Fragments, as great as Fragments is. The thing that I heard closest to that was a take of Can't Wait. And I write about it in the book from like almost 15, 30 second intervals of how it unfolds. And it's, Jim had just arrived. It's January 14th. Everybody had been playing for a while. There's a version of Can't Wait that was done at the Teatro that actually sounds pretty good. It sounds, I think it's on Fragments too. There's another version that they did that I think is also included. It was like, and this was done on January 5th. It's like a Pink Floyd version of Can't Wait. To my ears, that's kind of bizarre and strange that it would go in that direction. But so when Jim arrived on the 14th, the take of Can't Wait that I heard that I found so revelatory, you initially hear Jim was playing a Wurlitzer electric piano. And that's hence the title of my book, Whirly Gig, because he was identified in session sheets as Whirly on track 20. So you hear him. It sounds like he's just sitting down at his instrument and he's just playing. Nobody else is playing. And then he starts just kind of like laying down this groove. And you hear Dylan a couple seconds into it go, yeah. And which was rare because there very few times where Dylan commented on someone's performance or what was going on in the room as a take was starting. And Jim plays like even a deeper groove. And maybe 25 seconds later, Dylan says again, yeah. And then the song starts. To me, at that moment, and those, especially the beginning and then at the end, it settles into this groove. And to my ears, it's what Time Out of Mind as a project as a whole kind of settles into after all these false starts, casting about for direction, all these players. It really feels like in that moment, something special really happens. And what is fascinating to me too is that at the 6 minute mark, I think it is, it kind of starts to fall apart. And Jim always called him, referred him to himself as the enemy of institutional order. So what I was hearing before he arrived was these great session players. I mean, you know, Bob Britt, Cindy Cashdowler, Keltner, they're fantastic. They can play anything. But it sounded, it just didn't have that extra like feeling of passion. I mean, it all sounds good, but it didn't sound transcendent. With Jim on that 7.5 minute take of Can't Wait, it goes somewhere that I didn't hear anywhere else. And not completely, but from the 14th on, something seemed to happen in general. I mean, there were different, you know, there might be like a jaunty Augie Myers organ part on Mississippi that kind of take it in a Tex-Mex feel that happens, everything. I'm not saying it's like completely there, but you can feel, And Jim told me later that he felt like, and Mark Howard said this, that Dylan wanted to feel Jim's presence, maybe even more than hearing his presence. And you can really, in this case, hear and feel profoundly, because it really, the session players seem to kind of like drop all sense of like professionalism and perfection. There are these kind of overtones and dissonances, and the whole thing just kind of winds down. It doesn't collapse, but it just kind of like winds down, and it just sounds like everybody just kind of let go for a little bit. And then at the very end, there are these like couple of like pristine, like pedal steel notes that are just like these like pretty sweet little notes that are almost the exact opposite. When I heard that, I actually took off the headphones and went to Mark Davidson's office. This is going to sound crazy, like with tears in my eyes. And I said, "Mark, I just found the 7.5 minutes where Time Out of Mind becomes Time Out of Mind." And I think, I was like, I have to nearly double and triple check the studio documentation. It sounds like it's an electric, World for Electric Piano. I said, I think it's when Jim is showing up, and it sounds like he's just trying out the instrument, you know, at the beginning of this particular take. And I mean, Craig, I must have listened to that a dozen times. And before I left Tulsa, the very last thing I did, I went back in and said, "Mark, can you, you know, can you key up the Can't Wait?" I had like all the ID and labeling information. I was like, I have to hear this version of Can't Wait one more time before I leave Tulsa, because in all likelihood, I'll never hear it again. And I was hoping, you know, when Fragments came out, it's like, I hope that's the version of Can't Wait. It's like, it's not. I think there's some maybe basic things that might be from that particular take. There may be some of it, but it's not what I heard that I felt was so, you know, just revelatory about the sessions and what they became. And I also think too that may have been a help to the likes of Dylan, and then even to Lanois, as far as like settling into that kind of groove in the book. I call it a ghosted groove, because Jim, I watched Jim do this once in Memphis. He invited me to sit in on a Screamin' Jay Hawkins session that he was doing. And this was fascinating. He had the Muscle Shoals rhythm section there, and this take on the song just was not going great. It was too like kind of generic or whatever. And Jim left the control room, went out on the studio floor, got on an organ, and told everybody, he laid down this groove and said, instructed everybody to play to this groove. He's like, play to this, play to me. He went back in the control room, turned his part all the way down so you couldn't hear him. But in that song, you could feel him. You could feel his presence. And that was part of like Jim's production approach. You know, he wasn't kicking things or throwing things or yelling at people. You know, he was more about, he's more about telling stories, setting a vibe, and kind of luring people towards something. And if he had to like go out there and actually play the part and say, play to this, and then turn himself, you know, all the way down, you know, he would do that too. So I think that's the man who like stepped into the criteria with those sort of, you know, coming from as being an extensive experience as a producer and as a session player, but also like as almost like as a shaman. Greil Marcus called him in his piece on Time Out of Mind a blues savant. And there's some, you know, truth to that. You know, Jim had this quality where he was almost like this philosopher, pirate, you know. In fact, the first time I met Jim at his house, he took me out to what he called his fortress of solitude. It was like this like small cabin, and we're playing music. He's playing me stuff, and he pulls what he said was a Moroccan hash knife out of his boot and cuts a rum cake that he had And he hands me this piece of rum cake and says, you got to have this. It's more rum than cake. I think you're going to like it. And then just proceeds to just tell some of the most incredible stories about sessions, whether it's hanging out with, you know, Keith Richards or recording Big Star's Third or whatever. And again, he was just one of these people who felt like it was his obligation to pass on this stuff. And it was so cool to hear him return from Criteria after these experiences. And he was totally clear. He was like, this album is one of Dylan's greatest. The lyrics are incredible. He said it's a blues album. And he said, if it survives intact, it will be considered, you know, one of his masterpiece records. He was right.
Yeah, his influence on Dylan is really interesting because, as you say, later Jim had this idea that maybe he was there to play a foil or a role versus Lenoir. But the other interesting thing about what you just talked about in the music is, you know, we know from a million stories that Dylan does not come in and tell musicians what to play, doesn't orchestrate or, you know, curate musicians. And it sounds like in Jim, he found someone who was able to give that, you know, some drive to the other musicians that he didn't. I don't know if that's true, but it just seems like, I always thought that was weird that for all the distinctive, you know, complex and diverse music we get, that Dylan doesn't come in the studio and say, you do this, you do this, you do this. Jim had this role for the musicians and for the music. He had this role for the production, but it also seems like his, you know, what you talked about, the feel, but the presence there gave Bob something he wanted to play off of.
I think that's really true. And I think that of all the people through the door, and again, you know, Keltner's great. They're all great musicians. But I think that, and Jim would never say anything that he was close to, you know, like a peer of Bob Dylan's, you know, he's not going to compare himself that way, or he wouldn't have. But I think for like, Dylan was always aware of Jim's work with Ry Cooder, what Jim had done, the rooms that Jim had been in when incredible music was made. Jim was not the sharpest studio musician. In fact, he always joked that if he could have capoed the piano, he'd have really had a career. And, you know, and Dylan would have known that. I don't think you bring Jim Dickinson in, especially at that point with all those players, if you want another hotshot session player. You bring him in because you want a presence, you want a feel. And to me, also, that was also brought out in the rapport that, because you also hear about Dylan recording with people and not speaking to any of them. Like, one reason why people, some people don't have stories is because they never had a conversation with Bob Dylan. You know, it's like he never looked me in the eye. I don't really have anything to say, you know? Right. But with Jim, they talked, you know, out in the parking lot. Dylan came up to him and asked him about Sleepy John Estes, because he knew Jim had played some shows way back in the day with Sleepy John Estes. And he wanted to know, hey, how did he make that chord? Because he knew Jim would know. And it was really kind of cool to think of, you know, that in his late 50s, that he was still kind of a student of the music, wanting to know like this kind of arcane knowledge, like how did Sleepy John Estes make this chord? And, you know, Jim was like, well, unless you do it with these fingers, it's not going to sound right. And he even sent Dylan a video of Sleepy John Estes playing that song. And and then Dylan shared some things with Jim too. Like one day during a break, he told Jim that he had just said, during one of my visits to Memphis, I went to Hume's, knowing that Jim would know exactly the meaning and why Bob Dylan would do that. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because Hume's is the high school in Memphis that Elvis Presley attended. And it's also the spot where he gave what some consider his first public performance. So he told Jim this story about going to Hume's high school, that Jim said has changed profoundly since Elvis's days. It's now like, you know, a very almost like, you know, sort of, you know, inner city, you know, Dylan. He went to the office and he said that he wanted to go to the auditorium. And Jim was saying, like, he could only imagine like Dylan in his cowboy hat and, you know, like walking through the halls at Humes High School because classes were in to go to the auditorium, almost like as a pilgrimage homage to like the spot where Elvis, you know, got his start as a performer. And Dylan told Jim that he walked into the auditorium, that he walked up on the wooden steps to the stage, walked out to the center of the stage, looked over the room, kind of took it all in. And then he said that he glanced down, he looked down, and he said he found a lucky penny that he picked up and pocketed. And that's the kind of rapport. So that's why I say that, like, at a time where Daniel Lanois, and again, I can't say enough, Daniel Lanois does such a great job, but at a time where he and Dylan are barely speaking, they're like butting heads about the direction of this album. You know, Dylan is off telling stories about like paying homage to Elvis Presley and talking about Sleepy John Estes, a blues great. You know, he's not talking about Pink Floyd licks. You know, he's talking about like these seminal figures in both of their development, you know, as musicians. I mean, I say in the book that Dylan and Jim can both remember a time before Elvis Presley. And, you know, the way their worlds changed after Elvis Presley, you know, kind of exploded and entered their worlds. In fact, Jim always said that anybody who tells you, Jim saw Elvis in the mid-50s before he really got huge. Saw him a couple of times. And wow. he told me, he said, anybody who says that they saw Elvis at that time and they were inspired to be a musician is lying, because there is no way you could have seen Elvis at that point with different, you know, reference points, like no reference point really, and say, I want to do that or I can do that. He said it was virtually impossible. He's like, it was like seeing something from, you know, another planet, like seeing something that you have no reference point for at all. So I think even just like that kind of feel and vibe. And I really think that Dylan had a level of almost, I don't want to say safety, but I really think that he would have seen and felt that Jim Dickinson was more of a contemporary kind of a peer, someone who had almost like been to these mountaintops himself and, you know, lived to tell the stories. I think that's, you know, I say that he accompanied Dylan down a road less traveled, and I think he really did. And I think, you know, Dylan at that point wanted that. And I think that that's what you can hear in the arc of those tapes from Teatro to the End, for that January 14th to the 21st, when Jim's there. I really do think you can hear that in that kind of almost like this settling into what Time Out of Mind became.
Having listened to the box for a couple of weeks before it's released, I started grouping the songs into playlists. And I had made the demarcation of the 14th for the start of this new sound. I had read your book, but I didn't remember the date. And I had to go back to see that it happened to line up. But I do think you can hear it, even if you didn't know. I mean, at least for me, it was very visible. And now a lot of people have listened to those playlists. Let's talk a little bit about, well, you tell an interesting story that Jim felt necessary to go talk to Daniel because he sensed something about his role and thought it was the, you know, right thing to do. Did you tell that story briefly?
Yeah, Jim was aware that, well, if you read Mark Howard's book, Mark talks about how, or writes that, I'm trying to think how much he shared when he was on with you as well, but there was a point where, okay, because there was a point where it seemed like, and again, he writes it in his book that basically Dylan and Lanois had almost stopped talking at all. And he even says that it seemed like Lanois at times was kind of banished to another room.
That he did say. Yeah.
There were times during, Jim talked about the first time it happened. They recorded something on the studio for, they all gather for playback. And Dylan says, what do you think of that, Jim? Well, Jim Dickinson said that immediately Jim Keltner starts to answer. You know, he has, you know, fairly extensive recording history with Dylan. And Dylan says, no, not you, I'm him. And he points to Jim Dickinson. And Jim offered his opinion. And it started happening more frequently. And it started happening to, I think, infrequently during these times, they would just hang out in the parking lot talking, you know, informally. So much so that being a producer himself, Jim Dickinson, he knew that on this session, he's technically a session player. And he understood that he could be seen that he was overstepping a boundary there, that the session player should not be offering, you know, production advice almost. So he sought out Lanois, went visited him at his hotel to say, you know, hey, this is happening. Sorry to sort of put you on the spot here. But he said, I realize, you know, I am kind of overstepping a bit here, but he did say, if Bob Dylan asks my opinion on something, I'm going to give him an answer. And Jim always told me, he always said too, that I will say shit that people from Los Angeles will not say. And I think that's the other component of that, is you can imagine that, especially in recording sessions, and, you know, that sounds great, Bob. Oh, that's great. That's fantastic. The thing you did there? Yeah, that sounds great. That sounds great. Who's going to say, no, that version, that sounds kind of crappy. I mean, go with a second version. Or Jim Dickinson would tell him that. You know, he would give him an honest appraisal of what's going on. So yeah, he did say that Daniel Lanois too was also very gracious, and that his response wasn't like, yeah, I wish you'd shut up. He didn't say anything like that. He said, you know, basically, that's what you're here for, and, you know, we'll keep going.
Yeah. Well, Lanois seems like a very diplomatic guy. He was interviewed about 2 weeks ago just about this in retrospect, and he, you know, doesn't step on anybody and is very complimentary and positive about, you know, about everything. It seems to be his way. You know, as I said in my review of your book, it seems like I would love to have him spill a little bit more. His side of the story from a pure point of view does seem like it's still a little bit missing. Two questions for you. One, mechanical. Did you, in your research or in what you saw in Tulsa, discover the dates that the final takes came from?
Not that I recall, because the way everything that I recall going through everything was it was all chronological from, you know, skeletal recordings at Teatro through it. It didn't seem like there was necessarily a demarcation of like, this is the last day of recording, because I think they went back and did some additional recording, almost like after players dispersed. And I know Jim was there.
Well, you said Jim left on the 20th.
14th to the 21st, I think, because there's another version of Can't Wait that also was recorded on the 21st that he's on.
Yeah, I was going to look yesterday when I saw that in your book. I reread parts of it. I think the last day in the Teatro is not far from there. There was some overdubs, Mark said, done back in Oxnard, but I don't think there's many days after. just whether, for example, what percentage of the final takes came after the 14th. You know, the people who are obsessively or looking at the level of detail of fragments right now that we have all the dates of those cuts, it would be very interesting to know when the final takes came, because you can sort of place them. I think, as you say, the sound and the feel and the pace even of the takes after the 14th seems more like what's on the album. But it's just something I'm trying to track down.
It is, and I don't really have anything additionally to share as far as something definitive. I mean, it'd be great when somebody does go in, whether it was the guy who was doing the videotapes and was hunched over, who had access.
Well, it was Len West's brother, and he got tossed after the first week. Bob sent him home, so those videos are all from week one.
Oh wow, okay, but. You know, but somebody will go in at some point and be able to do that, you know.
Well, Mark's got it. I haven't asked him for it, but Mark's got his engineer's book, his notebook with everything. So there's a definitive record somewhere. And then the last thing I want to ask is, if, to the degree you're comfortable saying, how do you think Jim would feel about the remix? What are your thoughts about the remix? But what do you think Jim would think, given the reaction he had to the actual album? And now we have someone took another swing at it.
I mean, I think Jim, I think Jim would be pleased with the remix, because I think it has less, like Jim always talked about like mood and atmosphere, and that people would go to Lanois for mood and atmosphere, but that Lanois's mood and atmosphere is generally like processed after the sessions. It's something that's added and layered after the sessions. I think what Jim would appreciate about the Brower remix is that you still, I think, get that mood and the atmosphere. It's there largely without that post-production stuff that Lanois is so good at. So I think in that case, Jim would like it, but I would bet that he would say, like he told me, one of the first things he said when he heard the completed Time Out of Mind was, he said, so much of it isn't there. And again, he's one of those few people in the world who experienced the recording of Time Out of Mind in all its chaos and beauty, in real time, with 12 people playing simultaneously. We're never going to hear that. And again, I think the closest thing that I've heard to it is that 7.5 minute version of Can't Wait that like brought me to tears. So I think Jim, especially from a production aspect, and Jim was a fan of Lanois. He's a fan of various producers. I think he would say, yeah, I like it. And I like that you can hear Cindy Cashdollar now, that you can hear Bob Britt now. But he would also be aware that someone is there pushing up those parts. And as you're pushing up those parts, you're bringing down potentially, 10 others. So as Michael Brower said to you, making some very hard choices. I mean, I love what he did. I think it sounds great. I mean, I think it's a great companion to the original Time Out of Mind, and I'm so glad it exists. I'm glad he did the work, and I think he did a fantastic job. But I'm also aware, like I think Jim would have been, that there's still so much of it not there. And I can only imagine how Jim would feel having experienced it in real time in the studio, headphones off, etc. I mean, I just got a fleeting glimpse of it, and I'll never forget it. I mean, if I'm back in Tulsa, I'm going to be hitting up Mark Davidson to try and cue up that 7:20 for me again, so I can.
Yeah. So right, now you've set a few people to have a new holy grail of unheard this specific Can't Wait from. What's the date of that track? Do you know?
It's the 14th, and
it's the 14th. Yeah, right. Yeah. You said the first one. Okay. Well, yeah. I will start a online petition tonight for it. So.
If it ever leaks and you hear about it, I would love to hear it again.
Well, John Lewis, thank you for all the effort you put into this great book. I know all the time out of mind hardcores have sought it out over the last few weeks. I'm sure a lot more will now. It's a thin book, but yeah, the writing is beautiful. The story is interesting. And the fact that you had, as I said in my review, right, these two secret weapons of a long time relationship with Jim, as well as access to the archives. You know, there's so many Dylan books that are basically, you know, listen to the album and share your thoughts. And those two inputs really shape this book and make it, you know, very special and help it's still a mystery. I mean, I've done this for a year now. It's still a mystery, but there's a lot more we know. And anyone who really wants to understand it should get themselves a copy of this. So thanks for taking some time and talking to us about it.
Well, thank you, Craig. And again, I think it speaks to the good work, again, that you've done, that as we fill in more of what we know, it almost becomes more mysterious in some ways. And again, that's a great thing about great art. And again, hats off to you for the way you've gone about this over the past year. So I admire everything that you've been doing. So thanks for including me.
Thanks, John.
Thanks for listening.